Welcome to the Federal Societies Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Societies Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, May 9th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Department of Labor's fiduciary rulemaking. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome two guests to our program today. We'll hear opening remarks of about 30 to 35 minutes from them. They're going to have a little conversation between the two of them, and then I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll get to the audience questions. We'll hear first from the Honorable Annette L. Nazareth. She's a partner at Davis Polk & Wardwell, joined by her partner, Jeffrey T. Dinwoodie. With that, let's begin with our opening remarks. Annette Nazareth.
Thanks, Dean. We're really delighted to be here today.
Yes, and thanks.
I can get started. Last month, the Department of Labor released its much-anticipated fiduciary rulemaking. The rulemaking was actually a comprehensive regulatory package consisting of three interconnected parts. First, a new definition of investment advice fiduciary. Second, two new prohibited transaction exemptions. And third, amendments to other prohibited transaction exemptions. The rulemaking package is daunting in its detail and scope, so our goal today is to give you a high-level overview of the new standards that were adopted through the first two components that I mentioned, the new definition of investment advice fiduciary and the two new prohibited transaction exemptions. The rulemaking has broad and significant implications for both investors and the financial services community. We will get into many of the details in a moment, but the bottom line takeaway is that with this rulemaking, the DOL has put in place a new test for when investment advice gives rise to fiduciary status and therefore a fiduciary duty on the part of the intermediary. The result is that many firms and individuals whose activities previously did not create a fiduciary duty under the Department of Labor's prior rules will now be subject to a higher duty of care and the prohibited transaction rules, which could limit the compensation those firms and individuals can receive in connection with their investment advice. The DOL has also established two new exemptions from the limitations imposed by the prohibited transaction rules. These exemptions are intended to provide firms with some degree of flexibility, but which in practice may be very challenging to implement. We'll discuss some of those challenges in a bit.
And as we'll discuss, this rulemaking has received significant interest from members of Congress, federal and state regulators, and FINRA, and the financial services industry and investor advocates, among others. In fact, the Department of Labor has reported that it received over 3,000 comment letters and over 300,000 petitions on its 2015 proposal. The rulemaking is premised on the notion that the marketplace for retirement advice has evolved significantly in the last several decades. Indeed, the retirement advice market is dramatically different now from when the Department of Labor and Treasury Department established a five-part test for identifying a fiduciary advisor in 1975. Perhaps the most notable change is that individual employees and retirees, rather than employers and professional money managers, have become increasingly responsible for their own retirement investment decisions. Today, individual account-based defined contribution plans, like 401k plans and IRAs, have become dominant and have generally replaced defined benefit pensions. And with the large number of baby boomers approaching retirement age, the Department of Labor and indeed President Obama himself believed that additional investor protections were necessary.
So at base, the DOL's historical five-part fiduciary test was viewed as no longer meeting the needs of investors in a changed landscape. Under the five-part test, many of the key advisors to employee plans, plan participants, and IRA owners were not deemed to be fiduciaries. So that's what led to this new DOL rulemaking. So having provided that very brief background and context, let's get into the specifics of the rulemaking.
So under ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code, one of the ways that a person is deemed a fiduciary is if he gives investment advice for a fee or other compensation, direct or indirect, with respect to plan or IRA investments. Through this rulemaking, the Department of Labor eliminated the 1975 five-part test that has been used for determining when a person is deemed to be rendering investment advice. And the Department of Labor has replaced it with a broader two-part test that captures a wider range of persons, entities, and activities.
So in a nutshell, the new two-part test is satisfied if a person is acting as a fiduciary advisor and in that capacity is providing a covered recommendation. A person could be deemed to satisfy the first element, acting as a fiduciary advisor, in one of three circumstances. First, if the person represents or acknowledges that he or she is acting as a fiduciary. Second, if the person renders the advice pursuant to an agreement or understanding that the advice is based on the recipient's particular needs. Or third, if the person directs the advice to a specific recipient or recipients regarding the advisability of a plan or IRA-related investment.
The second element of the test requires you to consider whether or not the person who is acting as a fiduciary advisor is providing a covered recommendation. A person is deemed to be providing a covered recommendation when he provides a recommendation regarding the advisability of buying or selling securities or investment property, or regarding how such assets should be invested or managed, or regarding IRA rollovers, distributions, or transfers.
Let me say a few words about how the term recommendation is defined. Since the existence of a recommendation is a central element to fiduciary status, the new rule defines a recommendation as a communication that, based on its content, context, and presentation, would reasonably be viewed as a suggestion that the advice recipient engage in or refrain from taking a particular course of action. The Department of Labor has taken an approach to defining a recommendation that is consistent with and indeed based on FINRA's approach for identifying a recommendation. A recommendation requires that there be essentially a call to action that a reasonable person would believe was a suggestion to make or hold a particular investment or pursue a particular investment strategy. Also, under a facts and circumstances test, the more individually tailored a communication is, the more likely that it will be viewed as a recommendation. In addition, a series of actions may be considered in the aggregate to be a recommendation, even if the individual actions on their own would not be deemed a recommendation. The new rule also adopts the FINRA position that it makes no difference in determining the existence of a recommendation, whether a communication was initiated by a person or on a computer software program.
The Department of Labor also explicitly excluded certain communications and activities from being deemed recommendations. For example, the rule makes clear that general communications, including those in general circulation, newsletters, or statements on talk shows, are not recommendations. Also, certain general education materials will not be considered recommendations under the rule. Except in specific situations, to be considered educational materials under the rule, the materials cannot discuss individual investments. Educational materials could include information and materials that describe the terms or operations of a plan or IRA, as long as they don't discuss the appropriateness of specific investments. They could also include providing questionnaires or worksheets that help an investor estimate his or her retirement needs, provided that certain conditions are met. Let's now take a moment to compare the DOL's new test against the old five-part test.
So under the old five-part test, an advisor would not be deemed a fiduciary unless each of the individual elements of the five-part test were satisfied for each instance of advice. One of the elements of the five-part test was that the advice had to be given, quote, on a regular basis. It was often the case that a person seeking advice in respect of an IRA or employee benefit plan was seeking advice on a one-time or episodic basis. Therefore, under the old test, a person or a financial institution that advised an investor on an IRA rollover or a similar one-off issue would not be meeting the regular basis element of the old five-part test, and thus would not be a fiduciary. There is no longer a regular basis element under the new rule. A single covered recommendation suffices. The old five-part test also required a mutual understanding that the advice would serve as the primary basis for an investment decision, which was easily rebutted by the advisor, including a written disclaimer in the client paperwork that said that any recommendations provided were not intended to be the primary basis for decision making. So this mutual understanding element has also not been carried over to the new test.
Another key difference is that under the old test, one could actually hold himself out as a fiduciary, but if all of the elements of the five-part test weren't satisfied, he would nevertheless fall outside of fiduciary status. Under the new test, if a person represents or acknowledges that he is acting as a fiduciary, then he is a fiduciary, full stop.
The DOL included in the rule several carve-outs from the fiduciary rule. Circumstances where a person is not deemed to be a fiduciary, regardless of his or her activities, provided that the person is not holding himself out as a fiduciary. For example, the rule contains an exception for arm's-length transactions with independent plan fiduciaries with financial expertise, which is sometimes referred to as the counterparty exception. This exemption generally provides that in the case of where a person does not purport to be a fiduciary, his advice provided in an arm's-length transaction to a plan or IRA will not create fiduciary status if the plan or IRA to whom the advice is given is represented by an independent fiduciary, that is either a bank, a registered investment advisor, a broker-dealer, an insurance carrier, or an independent fiduciary with at least $50 million in assets under management. The advisor must also inform the independent fiduciary that the advisor is not undertaking to provide impartial investment advice or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. In addition, the advisor cannot receive a fee or other compensation directly from the plan or IRA owner for the advice.
Right. So the main point of this exception is that both sides of the transaction understand that they are acting at arm's length, and neither party expects that the recommendations will necessarily be based on the buyer's best interests or that the buyer will rely on them as such. Let's now move to the exemptions from the prohibited transactions provisions. There's two key new ones under the rules. And to frame this, it's important to keep in mind that ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code and the rules thereunder forbid fiduciary advisors from engaging in certain prohibited transactions unless an exemption applies. Generally speaking, the prohibited transactions provisions prohibit a fiduciary from receiving commissions or any other transaction-based compensation in connection with transactions relating to a plan or IRA. They also prohibit a fiduciary from causing a plan or IRA to pay an additional fee to either the fiduciary or a person in which the fiduciary has an interest.
The rules also prohibit a fiduciary from receiving compensation from third parties in connection with a transaction involving the plan or IRA. So as we just explained, the DOL's new test for identifying advice fiduciaries will cause many investment professionals to be deemed fiduciaries for the first time. Significantly, many of the compensation arrangements that are ordinarily employed by financial services firms, including broker-dealers, are generally not compatible with ERISA fiduciary status, as they would violate the prohibited transaction provisions that attach to advice fiduciaries. And as we explained, the prohibited transactions rules state that an advice fiduciary may not receive compensation that varies based on their investment advice or receive compensation from third parties in connection with that advice.
So, absent an exemption, a broker-dealer that is deemed a fiduciary advisor may not receive transaction-based compensation, including commissions or revenue-sharing payments or 12b-1 fees, which are payments that a broker could receive from a mutual fund for marketing and selling the fund's shares. They may also not accept related payments from third parties that provide investment products. So following the release of the Department of Labor's original 2010 rulemaking, a number of commenters raised concerns about the potentially disruptive effects that the rulemaking could have on firms' compensation practices. In response to these comments, the Department of Labor created something that a lot of people refer to as the BIC, or the BIC exemption, which stands for the Best Interest Contract Exemption. The BIC exemption is intended to give financial institutions flexibility. It imposes fiduciary standards, but also intends to provide advisors with some leeway to maintain a range of compensation practices. As we'll discuss further, there are some key practical challenges associated with using the exemption.
Under the Best Interest Contract Exemption, an advice fiduciary may receive transaction-based compensation and third-party payments that would otherwise be prohibited, provided that the fiduciary meets certain requirements, including acknowledging that it is a fiduciary and acknowledging and complying with an impartial conduct standard.
So the impartial conduct standard generally means that the fiduciary's advice must be in the best interests of the investor. The fiduciary must also not charge more than reasonable compensation and not make any misleading statement. An advice fiduciary must also meet several other conditions to rely on the BIC exemption, including adopting certain policies and procedures and complying with record-keeping requirements, among other things. I should also note that there is also a more streamlined version of the BIC exemption available for fiduciaries that receive only level fees, which are asset-based fees or set fees that don't vary based on the investment. There are also certain additional requirements under the BIC exemption for fiduciaries who restrict their recommendations either in whole or in part to their own proprietary products. But in the interest of time, let's not dive into those situations now, and I'll turn it back over to Annette.
Right. So one important point is that in order for an advice fiduciary to rely on the BIC exemption in respect of IRAs, the fiduciary must enter into an enforceable contract with the investor where the investor acknowledges its fiduciary status and that it will adhere to the impartial conduct standard. However, the exemption does not similarly require a fiduciary to execute a similar contract with respect to advice to ERISA plans, although there are still several documentation requirements for a fiduciary with respect to advice to those plans. The reason for this difference is fairly straightforward. Fiduciaries for ERISA plans can be personally liable for losses suffered by a plan for a violation of fiduciary standards. On the other hand, IRA fiduciaries that breach fiduciary standards are generally only liable to the IRS for excise taxes. IRA owners do not have a statutory right to bring suit against fiduciaries who have violated the prohibited transaction provisions. Thus, this contractual requirement gives IRA owners an avenue to bring a cause of action against advisors and their firms.
So in practice, broker-dealers and other firms that have looked at the BIC exemption are finding that the exemption is somewhat limited in its utility as it is fraught with implementation challenges and risk. For example, despite pleas from commenters, the release, unfortunately, does not provide much guidance on what an institution must do to prove that it has acted in an investor's best interest. Therefore, a firm that's considering using the BIC exemption is in a somewhat difficult place, particularly since the onus is on the firm to demonstrate that all of the conditions of the exemption have been satisfied.
In addition, a firm relying on the BIC exemption could be subject to meaningful litigation risk. There's a risk that months or years later, where a product or strategy that the advisor recommended has not performed well, the advisor would be second-guessed as to whether the recommendation that it gave to buy a particular product was truly in the customer's best interest, or whether a higher commission or markup earned from that transaction, as compared to, for instance, a transaction involving another product, caused the firm to put its own interests ahead of the customer's and thus fail to satisfy the best interest standard. As we all know, hindsight is 20/20, and so there is a risk that a firm's advice will be second-guessed.
It's also worth noting that the Department of Labor's 2015 proposal would have limited the BIC exemption to only a narrow, plain vanilla list of approved investments. The Department of Labor eliminated this approved list in the final version of the exemption, making the BIC exemption applicable, at least on its face, to all forms of investments. But that being said, in the preamble to the final exemption, the Department of Labor indicated that assets outside of the scope of the originally proposed approved list would merit a special attention and care and would be subject to additional scrutiny. As you can imagine, this makes broker-dealers and other firms uncomfortable about the risk of being second-guessed.
The DOL's rulemaking package also includes a new class exemption that permits advice fiduciaries to enter into a limited set of principal transactions involving debt securities with plans, plan accounts, or IRAs, and to receive markups, markdowns, or similar payments as a result of the advisor's advice. This principal transaction exemption only applies, however, with respect to debt securities, CDs, or interests in a unit investment trust.
So as is the case under the BIC exemption, the advisor must affirmatively agree that it is a fiduciary. Among other things, the advisor must also agree to comply with impartial conduct standards, which include the same best interest requirements and challenges that we just discussed in the context of the BIC exemption.
So that was a very high-level summary of the rulemaking. And in the interest of time, we admittedly had to leave out many of the details and nuances. But we'd like now to turn our attention to certain practical issues and considerations, and I'll have Jeff start on that.
Sure. So while there certainly are some potential benefits that this rulemaking brings to investors, one of the drawbacks of the rulemaking is that from the perspective of investors, the rulemaking further complicates what is already a very complex and confusing landscape of rules and standards that apply to investment-related advice. So putting aside the DOL rulemaking for a moment, it is already the case that many investors are confused by and don't understand the different legal and regulatory standards that apply to the financial advice that they receive.
Well, that's certainly the case. And to get more specific, a large proportion of financial professionals that provide investment advice with respect to employer plans and IRAs and more generally securities are associated persons of registered investment advisors or broker-dealers. But the regulatory standards that relate to the advice that investment advisors and broker-dealers and their personnel provide to retail investors are not entirely consistent. Investment advisor regulation is generally principles-based, and investment advisors do have a fiduciary duty that they owe to their clients.
And on the other hand, the regulation of broker-dealers is generally rules-based. Broker-dealers are not subject to a fiduciary duty under the federal securities laws, but they are subject to anti-fraud provisions and FINRA rules that require that they comply with just and equitable principles of trade. Broker-dealers are also subject to SEC and FINRA business conduct standards, and they're also subject to suitability requirements. So again, it is already the case that different standards apply to financial advice given to retail investors, even though, from the perspective of many investors, there is not much difference in the advice function that is provided by different types of entities. But now, with this rulemaking, a large proportion of broker-dealers will be deemed ERISA fiduciaries, but only for their advice as it pertains to plans or IRAs. And similarly, investment advisors, which are already subject to a fiduciary standard under the Advisors Act, will be subject to additional regulatory requirements when providing advice concerning plans or IRAs in the form of the prohibited transaction provisions.
Not surprisingly, studies have shown that many retail investors don't understand or are confused by the different standards of care that apply to investment advisors and broker-dealers and other financial services firms and their associated persons. The rulemaking makes that a bit more confusing, unfortunately.
So these issues concerning the inconsistent legal and regulatory standards and how they impact investors, it has received a lot of attention over the past few years. For example, the Dodd-Frank Act required the SEC to conduct a study of the effectiveness of the existing standards of care for investment advice to retail investors. Now, the SEC staff completed this study back in 2011, and they recommended that the commission harmonize the standard of conduct, or the standards of conduct, I should say, that broker-dealers and investment advisors must satisfy when giving personalized investment advice to retail investors. It's unclear whether there has been much support at the commission level for the SEC staff's recommendations. Despite, and we'll talk about maybe in a little bit, the statements that have been made. But what is clear is that the SEC hasn't proposed any such rulemaking.
Right. And one of the objections that some critics had to the DOL rulemaking was that the government should instead try to figure out a way to develop a holistic standard that applied consistently to financial and securities advice provided to retail investors. Some also argued that the Department of Labor should have either waited for the SEC to make progress on any plans to harmonize broker-dealer and investment advisor standards, or should have completed the rulemaking on a concurrent basis with any related SEC rulemaking. What's clear, though, obviously, is that the DOL decided, with the very strong support of the White House, that it would move ahead with the rulemaking, even in the absence of SEC action. Indeed, a strong incentive to ensure the rules were adopted before the end of Obama's term was quite clear. So why don't we turn again to some of the impact on the firms, Jeff?
Right. So in a nutshell, the rulemaking has profound impacts on firms and their personnel. For broker-dealers and their associated persons, the implications are particularly acute. As we've mentioned, compensation in a broker-dealer relationship is typically transaction-based and earned through commissions and markups and similar fees on specific transactions. So absent an exemption, a broker-dealer or any other financial institution or person that is deemed an advice fiduciary would be prohibited from collecting commissions or similar fees in connection with advice given to plans, plan participants, or IRA investors. With the new widened scope of fiduciary status, broker-dealers now have a lot of thinking and strategizing to do, and frankly, difficult decisions to make as they ponder life under the new expanded fiduciary definition.
Right. I mean, very broadly speaking, there are a few general avenues they can consider in this new world. First, they could consider restructuring their business models or restricting their activities and communications so that they're not deemed to be acting as a fiduciary under the new definition. That would require that they be very careful about the communications they make to and in respect of plans and IRAs, and essentially they would have to generalize any such communications so that they wouldn't be deemed recommendations. That all sounds very simple in theory, but obviously it would significantly change their business and it would significantly impair their ability to sell investment products, so that's probably not the first choice people would make.
Right. And so the second general approach that they could consider would be to accept the fact that in some cases they will be deemed fiduciaries and make some difficult choices from there. So on one hand, a firm could try to adjust its business model to rely more on an advisor-style account structure and receive only a fixed fee from customers, which in some cases would be a huge change. The firm would also have to forgo accepting any other payments based on individual sales or products purchased. And so the conversion from a brokerage-style commission-based account to a fee-based account model would have significant economic ramifications for firms, and it's not a simple, straightforward exercise. And by the way, on the other hand, as we've just discussed, rather than moving their accounts to a fee-based model, a firm could also try to avail itself of the BIC exemption and try to cope or live with the various challenges and risk associated with it.
And one significant challenge for brokers who offer retirement products will be how to structure their businesses where they offer both retirement and non-retirement products. You'll recall that we said the standard of care for broker-dealers generally outside of the retirement product context isn't a fiduciary standard, but as you know, it's a suitability standard. So query how brokers will restructure their businesses to avoid customer confusion over the standard of care that the broker is employing with respect to any particular recommendation. These issues will be particularly acute if the same registered rep is offering retirement products and traditional securities products. So the bottom line is that broker-dealers and other types of firms now must take a close look at their business models and do some deep thinking about how to operate in this new paradigm. Whatever path or combination of paths they choose are going to require some legal legwork, as firms will need to repaper agreements, possibly prepare and distribute disclosures, and modify policies, procedures, and processes, as well as implementing new training programs, just to name a few tasks. And what makes all of this more challenging and difficult is the fact that the rulemaking and the related implementation work is really multidisciplinary. It's really quite complex in that it will require, I suspect, the advice from ERISA lawyers as well as broker-dealer lawyers and in some cases investment advisory lawyers as well.
Right. And Dean, so we'll turn it back over to you in just a second, but I just want to add one other thing. It's the fact that firms don't have much time here. The majority of the provisions of the final regulation become effective next year in April 2017. And there's a transition period from April 2017 to January 2018 for complying with certain conditions of the BIC exemption. So that's a good place to stop. Dean, I'll turn it back over to you to see if either you have some questions that you want to go over or if anybody in the audience does. Thanks.
Thank you both. That was a very comprehensive and helpful recounting of what's happened here. I do have a few questions. While I'm asking my questions, I'm going to open the line so other people can begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button, then the pound button to indicate you have a question. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Before I go to my first question, let me remind folks that our schedule of upcoming Teleform conference calls is available on the Federalist Society's website. We do about 140 of these calls a year, so it's a plentiful and varied schedule. Our next scheduled call is Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about juvenile sex offender registration and the Adam Walsh Act. Let me start things off here by asking you, you touched on this a little bit, but maybe you could say more about why the Department of Labor didn't wait for the Securities and Exchange Commission to act before its own rulemaking on fiduciaries.
Well, I'll take a crack at that. You know, I don't think we know for certain. I certainly think that there's been a strong sense that you know, modifying the standard of care with respect to these retirement accounts was a very high priority for the Obama administration. And I think it was very clear that they wanted to get a rule finalized and get an implementation timeline at least started before the end of the president's second term. I believe that there was concern, clearly, that the SEC wasn't in a position to act on the same time frame. I think we all sort of speculate about what some of the reasons were for that. I mean, they're varied. Obviously, the SEC has been looking at this issue for a very long time, even before Dodd-Frank, I believe. And I think, you know, clearly after Dodd-Frank, there were a lot of competing SEC rulemakings and priorities. They're still working to complete the mandates under Dodd-Frank. There's pretty obviously a lack of consensus or agreement at the commissioner level. It's probably even more difficult now that they're down to three commissioners, which I think makes it difficult. I think the SEC, as you know, has real challenges in you know, meeting the challenges of the cost-benefit requirements to their rulemakings. I think there's been a lot of debate internally there about whether or not these changes were necessary on the broker-dealer side. There's been a lot of study internally. I know that at least two chairs have sent questions to the Office of, DERA, Division of Economic Analysis and Research, to analyze whether the current suitability standard had in some way sort of impaired the investor experience. And I think, you know, the jury was a little bit out on that. So I think they, you know, notwithstanding that they say they're sort of committed to move ahead with something, I think it's really quite unclear exactly what they will do. And so, you know, given the imperative, I guess, of the Obama administration to act on this, particularly because they were concerned about the retirement issues for an aging population, they clearly decided to move ahead. That having been said, I think you can see that there was some, at least some deference or advice perhaps provided by the SEC. Did you want to say something about that, Jeff?
No, I agree with everything you just said. You know, one thing to add is another factor is that, look, this is any such action by the SEC, it's a complicated issue, and there's a lot of sort of trickle-down consequences that they would have to think through and that FINRA would have to think through. So I think, you know, that's partially to blame for the fact that they haven't done anything here, in addition to all the different factors Annette just described, and including that they have had their plate very full with Dodd-Frank.
I also think the commission was more concerned about ultimately sort of what was going to be, and as they should be, what was going to be the impact on the broker-dealer model. I mean, really, how would this change of the imposition of a fiduciary standard be applied in the context, in a broker-dealer context, emphasis on dealer. I mean, dealers are acting as principals. And, you know, how would you transition to that in a way that worked? So it was somewhat more complicated.
Yeah, how to implement a standard with a, in some ways, a business-neutral model, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, we talked about a little bit earlier some of the criticism of the DOL rulemaking was, well, there's not much guidance in terms of what a firm should or should not do in respect of meeting the best interest standards. I mean, that's a difficult thing to write down and set a standard on paper because there's so many different circumstances. So I think that's another thing when the commission takes this up, if they do, to be able to put down on paper standards that people can follow and make sense of.
I want to ask a couple questions about reactions to the rulemaking. What you mentioned in opening FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. What has their reaction been, and has it changed throughout the rulemaking process?
Sure. So I'll handle that first. So look, it's very clear that FINRA was and has been very, very focused on this rulemaking, as it obviously goes to the heart of their members' business models. So they submitted comment letters on the proposals. In a nutshell, they've over the years supported a best interest of the customer standard. During the rulemaking process, they expressed a number of different concerns about the proposals, including, generally speaking, lack of helpful guidance, unworkable exemptions. They expressed some concern as to whether or not the rulemaking would cause some broker-dealers to have to either completely change their business models or shut down their business. They also have mentioned, or Rick Ketchum has mentioned, that concern as to whether or not it's optimal to have different legal standards that apply in respect to IRAs and 401ks as compared to the rest of investors' portfolios. That's frankly along the lines of the first of the policy issues we were discussing earlier. After the rulemaking has come out, it's not crystal clear what FINRA's position is on it. Like everybody else, I think that they're probably digesting the pages and pages and binders of documents. There have been some quotes. I think FINRA's CEO, Rick Ketchum, might have been asked at a conference, and I think he generally said, look, he thinks the final rule is much better and that major strides have been made. But I think he, at the same time, mentioned that, you know, we'll wait and see what the future looks like in terms of whether or not enough changes have been made to not significantly disrupt broker-dealers' business models. So do you have anything to add on that?
No, I agree with all that.
And I, again, sticking with the theme of reactions, I understand that some members of Congress are reacting and maybe even planning on some bills relating to the rulemaking. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, I can take that one. There has been obviously a lot of interest in Congress on this issue for a long time, and certainly since this rulemaking was adopted, there's been even continuing action on the part of Congress. I mean, you may know that the House passed recently a resolution of disapproval, which is a resolution to stop the Department of Labor from implementing the rule. I don't think that that's going to really go anywhere, obviously, because the introduction of a resolution of disapproval has to be signed by the president, and obviously that is not going to happen here, so that is a largely symbolic gesture. There have also been members of the House and Senate who've introduced various bills that would disapprove of the DOL's fiduciary rule. They've been very varied, but some of them have done things like try to replace the DOL's rulemaking with a best interest standard that would be imposed by law across the entire retail market, not just for retirement accounts. Again, something that would be quite different from what was adopted. Again, I don't think I think all of these have very little chance of passing. It does point out, though, that this still remains a very hot topic and something that I guess enough people were concerned about that they continue to visit the Hill and seek additional help.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is it will be interesting, and in some ways this ship has already sailed, as to whether these discussions on the Hill put more pressure on the SEC to do something in this space. You could argue that, well, maybe that should have happened a year or two ago, any such pressure being applied. But again, the SEC has certainly had their hands full over the last 2 years. So it will be interesting to see, any such pressure, what happens with the SEC, and including, I think Annette mentioned earlier, they have two open commissioner seats, so it's unclear what the position of the two new commissioners will be on any of these issues.
Yeah, maybe, Jeff, your allusion to the SEC having its hands full over the past few years, maybe that's an allusion to litigation against the SEC. I don't know. But let me conclude my questions with that. Are there efforts in this rulemaking, litigation efforts, to halt the rule, strike it down, enjoin it?
Well, we're not privy to any great secrets here, but it's certainly pretty clear that there were at least some trade associations or interest groups that were very concerned about this rulemaking and were prepared to to file suit. I don't know if they've decided to do so. I mean, the two that had gotten the most attention were the Chamber of Commerce and the American Council of Life Insurers. There may be other groups as well. You know, I think they had retained counsel and probably had taken steps to be prepared. Obviously, they would now both be adapting their papers in light of the final rulemakings and obviously going to their members and deciding on the basis of the final changes. And there were many. I mean, it was quite clear that the Department of Labor tried hard to address a number of concerns. And so the question is, as a result of that, do these various groups decide to forbear, or do they do what has become much more common in the world than it used to be, which is, you know, suing the regulators or suing the government to stop this action. So we really don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Sure. No, I understand. I understand. We got quite a few questions lined up here. Let's turn to our audience for the first question.
Hi, this is Craig Heimowitz. I had a question. I was wondering whether you've had a chance to figure out what the impact might be on traditional functions of clearing firms, which are traditionally mostly ministerial for broker-dealers, whether any of these new obligations would fall on them if they're just doing clearing functions, or might tangentially affect, you know, sometimes they can get payment for order flow or the suitability and concentration analysis they have to do under sort of anti-fraud, anti-money laundering.
So look, we, you know, we've been thinking generally about these issues. You know, I would address that by saying, look, it's a matter of looking at sort of going from first principles and thinking about, look, is there a situation where that clearing firm is providing something that could be deemed a recommendation in respect of 401ks or IRAs? You know, I think the way I would approach that is thinking through again at that first level whether that's the case. Sort of off the top of my head, I don't see that, but I think you would want to think closely about that and go from there. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I don't think that clearing firms are generally viewed as providing recommendations or investment advice. So off the top of my head, I would say that I don't think that that would be covered, but obviously we want to look at it more carefully.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but it's, yeah. They tend to get sued with everyone because they print the statements.
Yeah, and I understand. Yeah, but I think it would be quite different here where they're really just, you know, just providing a clearing function. I don't think that that would go to the issues of the recommendations.
Thank you.
Looks like we've got four questions pending, so let's move forward to our next caller.
How should firms think about what is reasonable compensation and what is not under the DOL's impartial conduct standards test?
Look, I don't, unfortunately, and this is probably why you're asking the question, I don't have a great answer for that one either, you know.
Well, I think the problem is you're going to be under some pressure to show that it was basically in line with what others were charging, right? I mean, the devil's going to be in the details and how this gets implemented. But I do think that ultimately, as we said, you talk about being second-guessed later on. If the compensation is, you know, richer than would otherwise have been the case with other products, and then it turns out that those other products performed more favorably, I think with the benefit of hindsight, it's going to be difficult to, you know, it could be difficult to defend yourself under the best interest standard.
So you don't see the Department of Labor having some sort of formula or form of calculation for reasonable compensation?
No, I don't believe so. I don't think that's their intention.
Thank you.
Let's continue on here. We've got three questions pending. About 10 minutes left.
Hi, thank you. You mentioned the conflict between, you know, the retirement business and non-retirement business at the broker-dealer level. Is your sense that a lot of brokers will just default to the DOL rule, particularly with the view that the SEC will probably put a broader rule in place at some point anyway?
You know, I don't, I guess I don't see that. I mean, the time will tell. I think it's sufficiently difficult to adopt that I think the money has been betting more on firms doing more activity under an advisory model to get out from under the difficult provisions of this, you know, the concepts in this rule, that it will just be, and again, that will be very difficult for some firms. A lot of firms are, you know, the traditional broker-dealers, obviously, you know, compensate their brokers with, you know, transaction-based compensation and the like. So I would think in the interim, what they'll try to do is figure out how to split the activities and continue to compensate their brokers for the traditional activity the way they currently are doing it, or start thinking about moving more of the activities into managed, you know, sort of advised accounts.
Yeah, so one thing I would add, and just as an aside, and I thought it was a clever idea. I've seen some people discuss it, including, I think, Dan Gallagher when he was a commissioner. It's the idea of, and it's interesting to think about, is if and when the SEC takes action, whether or not the Department of Labor would, again, I think this in some ways is a bit of a pipe dream, but whether they would have some sort of substituted compliance recognition, whereas if you're complying with whatever the SEC standards are under any new rulemaking for broker-dealers or investment advisors, whether that would suffice, again, that gets to this issue of that a lot of people have been frustrated with, that saying, okay, well, the SEC and FINRA are the frontline regulators of broker-dealers, so why is it that the Department of Labor's rulemaking is applying so significantly to them? Again, whether that's a good or a bad argument, you know, setting that aside, but I think that's an interesting question.
It's an interesting idea. I think it has very little chance of being reality.
Yeah, sometimes the most interesting ideas are doomed from the beginning, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true.
A couple questions pending. Let's move on to our next caller.
Hello, this is Louis Woodall from Risk Magazine. I was wondering if there was any scope for clients to continue to be serviced through brokerage channels, if those brokerage channels emulate to some extent the characteristics of advisory channels. For example, instead of having variable compensation paid to broker-dealers for different products, perhaps a broker-dealer could internally equalize the different levels of compensation so that no matter what products are sold or recommended to clients, the broker-dealer receives the same level of compensation. Would this be enough to get firms out of having to sign a BIC for these sort of channels?
Are you saying but your question relates to the retirement accounts?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, as Jeff mentioned in his remarks, there is a sort of level fee part of the BIC exemption that is somewhat easier to comply with, right, Jeff? So there is some thought that if you do have level fees, that the burdens should be somewhat less onerous because, in fact, obviously unlevel fees are what are one indicia of sort of the conflict of interest notion that is embedded in this rulemaking.
Yeah, so it's an interesting idea. I would want to think more closely as to whether or not that, on one hand, could fit under the more streamlined level fee exemption version of the BIC. Also, more generally, although you said that, you know, you could have the broker-dealer making certain payments or transfers to sort of level out the fees, I think it would also be important to think more broadly about other conflicts that could implicate the prohibited transactions provisions. Mm-hmm. So, again, like anything else, it would be a very detailed, fact-intensive analysis, but that's an interesting idea you
Thank you.
I think, have time to squeeze one more question in. Let's move on.
Hi, this is Vicki Hulick from ACA Compliance Group. The biggest question we're receiving from our sort of pure advisory type clients is with respect to the exclusion about the provision of discretionary advice and the fact that the BIC doesn't really apply if you are providing discretionary advice. And so my question really goes to, you know, how do you guys see the intersection of, you know, the sort of the pure advisor who's providing everything for assets under management fees, maybe a flat fee, but and is providing discretionary advice, but is providing that advice to an IRA that doesn't have an independent representative that qualifies under the $50 million limit?
Anybody want to take a shot at that one?
I think, you know, my initial reaction to that one is I think it would be difficult. It would be difficult to use the BIC, at least as I understand it. If it sounds like, and maybe I didn't understand the question, it sounds like part of the threshold requirements of the BIC wouldn't be met in that scenario you just posed.
No, I was really pointing more to the fact that most of, you know, most peer advisors, you know, are level fee. But the problem that we see is that there's the exclusion in the BIC that says doesn't apply if you're providing discretionary advice. So then what do they do? I mean, do they still have to comply with BIC because they already have a fiduciary standard because they're already a registered investment advisor providing advice to their clients? Or, you know, are they going to be looped in under this? And we're not getting a very clear answer because it seems like it's kind of convoluted in this particular issue.
Yeah, I think you raised a good question.
I am.
I think we'd have to look back at the language. So you're pointing out something interesting. You're saying even if you're already an advisor.
Yep, you're ready. You're a regular, you know, normal discretionary advisor.
Right, but this is basically this is making clear sort of what the sort of higher standard is, right, for everybody. With respect to, retirement accounts, so what you're saying is that even arguably you can read this, and I'd have to go back and look at it more carefully, but even those who are already advisors, not brokers who are now being sort of, challenged with this rulemaking, but even those who are already advisors may be subject to higher or different standards on the basis of this rulemaking.
Well, I guess where it, you know, it comes in is they talk about that, like right in the middle of some of these languages, they say, you know, does not exercise discretionary authority or control is sort of the term that they keep using, you know, in a number of places. So in I guess it's kind of a question is if the BIC doesn't apply if you're providing discretionary advice. I guess what is the transaction that really causes the BIC to be implicated if you're a level fee fiduciary under the definition under BIC, but then you are a discretionary advice investment advisor? I mean, would it only apply if they're going to recommend a rollover from a 401k into an IRA?
Yeah.
I mean, is that the only thing that would apply? Because that wouldn't really be discretion. That would just be a suggestion that they consider doing that. That would be looped in, whereas probably before it wouldn't have, right?
Yeah.
It would not.
Well, it sounds like there is a lot to be sorted out here, unfortunately.
It really is.
Yeah, we are out of our budgeted time, so we're going to have to leave it right there, I'm afraid. I want to thank both our guests, Jeff Dinwiddie and the Honorable Annette Nazareth, for joining us today. This has been extremely informative. I appreciate your time and your digestion of this complicated rule. Maybe after some further reflection, we can have you back and for another round, possibly. And a reminder to our audience, and thank you to our audience for joining us and for your thoughtful questions. Our next scheduled teleforum conference call is Wednesday at 1 p.m., but until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.